Accession number 14592, Reel 2.
Mr. Tutor, Reel 2. Were you supposed to be in formation when you went on this raid to Le Havre?
Oh, no. In those days, it was all very individual. It wasn't as it was later in the war. You took off at intervals. And everybody was on their own, and they all did their own thing. So you would be given a time of takeoff. But in effect, our squadron, 75, and 37 squadron, which of course was our sister squadron, you would take off at intervals over a period of, what would that be, 32 aircraft if you all went. You would all take off at intervals of 3 or 4 minutes. And you decided on your own route. You decided on your own method of attack. And you decided on your own return. It was all delightfully sort of unorganized, if you like. But having been briefed, you knew your target. Your navigator sorted it all out with the pilot. And having been given a takeoff time, that was it. You entirely did your own thing. And you picked up experience as you went. But there was no organization as they had with the mass raids later on, or even anything from about 42 onwards, I suppose. There was no such thing as keeping in formation or trying to all bomb at the same time and all that sort of thing. We used to just drift over and bomb. I suppose the idea was that it, from the target's point of view, you covered a period of an hour or so with one aircraft at a time coming in, sort of thing. That was the net result.
What height was it recommended you should bomb from?
Well, in those days, our maximum height was 10,000. We couldn't get above 10,000. At least not on a short trip. And normally, bombing that sort of target, short range, you wouldn't be more than 8,000 feet. With a Wimpy with full bomb load and with the old Pegasus engines, what a lot of people don't realise is that when we used to go out at night over the North Sea, you were only doing about 100 miles an hour, and you were scrambling for height, and with a bit of luck, by the time you crossed the Dutch coast, you might have made about 8,000. The result was that you generally, no matter what the target, you bombed at about 10,000, unless you were going to somewhere like Berlin, where you would endeavour to get up to 15, but from the one time I went to Berlin, I don't think we got above 12. They wouldn't make it with the full bomb load. So on these short trips to, say, Le Havre, we probably bombed at between 5 and 8,000, would be normal height.
How much did you know about flak concentrations to avoid?
Well, I don't think... I don't think information was awfully or was terribly good in those days, but we didn't know any better and we thought it was good. But obviously, if we were going to the Ruhr, you would be briefed on what concentrations there were, but... it was a bit, I should imagine, a bit scrappy, most of the information we got. Very much like the Met information we got, it was all rather primitive in those days. Fortunately for us, we didn't know that. We thought that's what it was all about. Icing up conditions and all that sort of thing. We used to have to contend with all that and bad weather and so on, which... and virtually nil in the way of good navigation. we thought that that was the standard way that things were. So, of course, we didn't worry about it unduly.
How did the raid on Berlin go?
That was a bit dicey. We had I was still a second pilot, and we drifted in, must have been about the first kite on the target, because it was a perfect night, and we literally drifted in over Berlin, nothing happening at all, no flak, no searchlights, very quiet. We decided to come in from the south. We went up the River Spree. We were supposed to be bombing the Tempelhof Aerodrome, I think, officially target. We got just about snap over the target, and everything came on, searchlights, flak, the lot, and we were coned. We dropped our bombs first, but we were coned, and that was my first experience of it. And the pilot managed to, he just went slap bang into a dive, and we managed to get out of it. And but I remember that I was in the Astrodome at the time, and my wireless op had come back, and we got pinned on the floor with the old centrifugal, and that was it until he pulled out. But we cleared the searchlights and we came back okay. But it was a long trip for us to go to Berlin and back. I should think it must have taken us about 10 hours. Probably about a 10-hour trip.
And you also attacked the Ruhr?
Oh, yes, I went to the Ruhr. Yes, I'd been to the Ruhr, Osnabrück. And I can't remember any other specific target. But I'd been to the Ruhr. Later on, of course, the Ruhr became a sort of, it became known as Happy Valley, and everybody dreaded the place, but because of the flak. But it was pretty severe in our time. But of course, you didn't have fighters, the number of fighters. You didn't have to contend with fighters as they did later on, because there were plenty of fighters, probably plenty around, but they were handicapped in that they didn't have radar. So you were rather unlucky if you met one. The flak was a bit vicious, and so were the searchlights. But of course, probably in that winter of 40, the worst thing you had to contend with, or as much as anything, was the weather. And the just managing to get back, navigating. Because we did everything on DR until you came back, got up well over the North Sea and virtually coming in, and then you would hope that your wireless op would get you a QDM, a course home, or a fix of some sort, because, in fact, it was very often it was your wireless op who brought you home. He, in turn, they didn't have they didn't have Marconi sets in those days. We had an old set called a Jeep set, which were again pretty primitive, and it was pretty marvellous in many ways that we ever sort of made it back home at all. I think it was largely due to the fact that most crews at that time, who were either regulars or VRs, had a pretty good training. Otherwise, getting back to base was quite often a problem.
A Jeep set, did you say?
Yeah, it's called a Jeep set. It preceded the Marconi. The Marconi came out about 19... I saw one. It was late 40 they equipped aircraft with the Marconi. A Jeep set, I don't know much about it, except that I know that if they wanted to change the wavelength, they had to take half the valves out, and you could stagger down the aircraft and you'd find the wireless op. It got his set virtually disemboweled with bits all over the place. And it was called a Jeep set in those days.
Any incidents that you remember from your raids in the autumn of 1940, apart, of course, from the one in which you got shot down?
Not really. We came back from Hamburg once on one engine. but that was just engine failure. It didn't stop entirely, but we had to cut it right back, and she just ticked over. Did that. We had a very bad. There was one do where we. The weather was incredibly bad, and we found out afterwards that in fact station commanders were given the option, or squadron commanders were given the option as to whether they would operate or not. And I think probably 75 was one of the few squadrons that decided they would operate. And they recalled us after we'd been gone about an hour or so, but I don't think more than about two or three actually got the recall signal. So we went on, we literally flew blind to the target. We bombed on ETA through the cloud, and there was a bit of flak, so we assumed that was probably near enough, and we flew back blind all the way. Then we were in real trouble because this was a time of great scares back at home, and a lot of the beacons, if there was a raid warning, the beacons wouldn't come on, so you couldn't pick up a beacon sometimes, and we couldn't pick up a beacon on this particular night, which would have given us a position. So we were floundering around trying to find out where we were. We were lucky. I decided to keep coming down until we cleared cloud base, which of course was a dangerous thing to do. But on the other hand, because I came out at about 1,000 feet or even less, and even your altimeter wasn't terribly reliable because of atmospheric conditions, you couldn't rely on it 100%. If you got change in pressure, your altimeter could be several hundred feet out. But we did. I decided to come down below the cloud, and we did. And we felt at least we were over land. Our one worry in those days was that you'd go all the way and then go out over the Atlantic the other side. We drifted around hopelessly for a long time, and I remember they also had at that time, if you found a searchlight, you were supposed to circle it and flash the letter of the day, and they were supposed to lay themselves down on a pointer to the nearest aerodrome. And we did find a searchlight, and I circled it, and it promptly went out. So we weren't getting any help that way, but when we were pretty short of petrol, and I was getting a bit scared. We did get a QDM out of my wireless op, and in effect, we actually found a flare path, and it turned out to be our home base, and we landed. Now, I think something like four or five of six of our aircraft just never got back to base that night, and they two of them crashed. One down in Devon, of all places, one up in Yorkshire. But the others got down at various aerodromes all over the place. So that was a very bad night. I think about three or four of us from my own squadron, out of about probably nine, actually landed. The ones who did best were the ones who stayed above cloud cover, or went up rather than down, and managed to get a QDM home. That was a pretty dodgy one. I don't think there's anything. You could have a completely uneventful trip. You learn something from every trip, of course. I remember we got lost once coming back from Lorient. We went down to bomb the submarine pens there. And I was a skipper then. And we came back, and we were supposed to make landfall at somewhere down in Portland Bill, but in actual fact, we spotted a beacon signifying a balloon barrage, and my navigator, who was a New Zealander, his geography wasn't of the UK, wasn't all that strong, kept trying to tell me it was Portsmouth, but I decided to fly west along the coast rather than risk going in. We had to turn over Boscombe Down before we went off to Norfolk, and so I flew due west, and we suddenly saw chalk cliffs, and I recognised that it was the Isle of Wight. We were over the Needles, but that was visual, and it was just fortunate that I happened to know the Isle of Wight. And we did make it okay. We shortcut over Bournemouth. That was the only time we ever saw a British fighter. We were intercepted by a Blenheim just leaving Bournemouth, which was a bit frightening. We flashed madly at him the letter of the day, and he left us alone eventually, but that was the only time over the UK we ever met a night fighter. And so we got back okay.
How effective do you think raids like on the Lorient U-boat pens were?
Well, of course, we got no idea. That's the tragedy. I mean, we thought we did infinitely better than, in fact, as it turned out, we did. But we didn't know that. We tended to think we'd done rather well on a number of them. Certainly... We were still in right up till about November, I think, until after Coventry. We were still very much under instructions to bomb specific military targets. There was no question if you the theory was that if you couldn't find your target, you might be given an alternative, but in theory, you would then bring your bombs back. In fact, we seldom, if ever, did. But on the other hand, we did endeavour to pick out the so-called target, which was usually a marshalling yard or an aerodrome or a factory or something. And it was only after Coventry that we were sort of literally told that, OK, you know, I mean, if you can't find your target, you just lob them down on the town. Which made a lot of difference. I mean, we went to Hamburg, we went to various other places, and if conditions were that bad, you would bomb on. You just simply bombed on ETA, or if you could see it, or if you went into the middle of the flak and you bombed that.
So the German Air Force raid on Coventry made such a big difference.
Oh, it did. I think, in effect, it must have made, I presume, the powers that be decided then, right, okay, there's nothing wrong with pattern bombing, or you can bomb a town. If the Germans can do it to us, we can do it to them. And, of course, not long after that, they did London. They started on London.
Was there any sense of outrage in the RAF at the destruction of the centre of Coventry?
It's difficult to know. Difficult to know, or to remember, quite frankly. I imagine there may have been, but not outstandingly so. I think we all realised by that time that we... I mean, because we'd been through the business of the so-called German invasion, which never came off. We'd been told on that occasion, Archibald Sinclair came down and gave us a pep talk, and then after that we were told that on the 15th of September, I think it was, that to expect the invasion. And I remember being somebody asking at briefing, what happens if you're hit, because the idea was that we would go back and forth and bomb the barges as they were coming across. And they said, well, you just prang a barge, you know, that was the idea. So we knew that's there was that sort of attitude. So I don't think that anybody got overexcited, perhaps, at Coventry in London. It would have been a very different thing if you'd actually had some relatives there or something like that, but I don't think so.
It wasn't Sinclair who said, praying at Barge, was it?
No, that would have been at a briefing afterwards. No, he came down and gave, I remember he gave us the date. We were expecting the 5th, I think it was the 15th of September.
What impression did he personally make?
Not a lot. Insofar as, quite rightly, I suppose, they rounded up all the New Zealand personnel and he really gave them the talk. And then only afterwards did he give a little general few words to all of us. Although, in fact, as I said, that was probably less than half the flying aircrew personnel. But I think they insisted that he sort of talked to the New Zealanders. He didn't make any great impression on me at all, I'm afraid, at that time.
Now, can we go on to the day you were shot down, and can you describe what happened, please?
Yeah. Well, it was our 21st raid. In actual fact, I'd only done about 18, because I was off 3 days with flu, but my crew had done 21. And my rear gunner, who'd been with us all the time, and who was an excellent gunner too, he decided, he got a transfer to another squadron. And so I had a new gunner with me. And I had a fairly new second pilot. We used to change, sometimes second pilots came and went. But it was Mannheim, the target. We had no problems outward. We located the target reasonably well. I would pretty well guarantee we were there okay. And we dropped our bombs okay. And we were coming out. And there was frantic explosion. And we got a direct hit with flak. Didn't know what it was at the time, but as up till then my instruments had been perfectly okay, there was no question of engine failure or anything. We got a direct hit port engine. I saw the air screw fly off in one direction, but I was subsequently told by other members of the crew that there was a fire in the engine and that there was a huge hole in the wing. I never saw that. I was endeavouring to keep her, to try and regain control, because we didn't know what damage had been done. I went down, I probably got control again at about 7,000 feet. By that time I realised we got no gyros, which meant that most of the instruments of my panel went. And I was down to a compass and an altimeter. I imagine we were full of holes, but nobody had been hit. But there were some very odd things about her which made me think that we were rather more damaged than she appeared at first. She was extremely difficult to fly. I had to use bias in every direction, and she gradually got worse and worse from that point of view. But anyway, we decided to set off home. My navigator gave me a course. I said, I told him, you can vary the course, we'll not go out over. Just give me a course for UK. And the shortest one you can make it, and we'll worry about it once we get over across the channel. Otherwise, of course, we would have gone out and across the North Sea and back into Norfolk. We decided to jettison everything in the aircraft we could. Eventually, I pulled the two gunners out of their turrets, and they did. They jettisoned flares and anything they could find loose in the aircraft. I'm told that Chris Scott, our second pilot, attacked the Elson with a fire axe, and they decided they even jettisoned that. The only thing, they kept the bed, but she wouldn't maintain height. Now, of course, the Wimpy didn't necessarily maintain height on one engine. She was supposed to be okay once you got down to about 2,000 feet. But she got more and more wing heavy. She was extremely difficult to handle. We had no intercom. That went. I don't know, the things, you know, it's a bit of Sod's law, and if one thing goes wrong, it continues to go wrong and gets worse and worse. So, I should think after we've been flying about an hour and only doing about 100 miles an hour, I mean, I was trying to keep it going, I realised that the starboard engine wasn't entirely happy. She was overheating. And we seemed to be lacking in oil pressure, so I told them that just after the main spar, there's a little Zwicky pump, which you could pump oil into the engine. So I told them to do that. And I was a bit disconcerted not long afterwards when my front gunner came up to me, and of course without intercom we couldn't shout, but he was brandishing the handle of the Zwicky pump, which had broken. And so I simply said to him, if you want to get home, Willie, I said, mend that bloody pump, sort of thing. But of course they couldn't. When we got to about 2,000 feet, I was using my navigator as a runner because we hadn't got any intercom. So I told him to go back and tell every member of the crew that there was only a 50-50 chance of getting back, and if they wanted to bail out, we were at 2,000 and they could bail out. And he came back and said, what are you going to do, Skipper? Which was a silly question because I couldn't leave the controls with without any sort of automatic pilot, and in the condition she was, I was having an awful strain to just keep her going. And I mean, if you'd once sort of made half a move, she'd have gone straight over on her back. So I said, well, I'm sticking. He said, oh well, we'll stick. So we pressed on. We realised Rouen. We were down to about probably 1,000 feet by then, and she wasn't maintaining height. And we sighted the coast, and I told him to go back and sort out dinghy drill, which wasn't a very pleasant prospect, it being December and snow on the ground, and not a very happy idea. And Wimpy, of course, this was supposed to float for 90 seconds, guaranteed, which nobody believed. Anyway, I told him to do up my harness. We never used to use the harness in those days. I don't know why. We never harnessed ourselves. It was only a lap strap, but we never used it. So I told him to buckle me in. And he couldn't manage it because the thing had never been used for so long, I suppose, and he couldn't adjust it. So I said, okay, leave it. So, of course, I had no harness. And very shortly after that,